Storylines New England is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Okay, children, you want to come and gather around here? I have some stories for you.
On most afternoons, the children's room in Manchester, New Hampshire's City Library is bustling with kids. They curl up in corners with their favorite books, search the shelves for something new, or gather in a circle to listen as an adult leads them off into the land of imagination.
'Twas the night before Christmas when all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a...
Mouse, yes.
We're doing that dance for ballet.
You've been doing... Oh, you did that dance for ballet?
The children's room provides entertainment and intellectual stimulation for hundreds of kids, but its larger goal is the encouragement of lifelong reading habits in its young customers. Kathy Urey, the Children's Services Coordinator for the Manchester City Library, conducts its storytime readings.
I think I get more than I give. My delight in reading the book is to introduce children and parents to good children's books. The great part, of course, is seeing people here in the library and saying, "Oh, we love the story you read," or seeing people outside the library and they remember the stories being read by you. It's very heartening to see people enjoying books because it's not just the enjoyment of the book, but the importance of reading. And it has to begin with that young child. What did he see?
Saint Nick.
Saint Nick, yes. Santa Claus, huh? In this story, you call him Saint Nick.
New England invented the public library children's room, and today, libraries across the country provide a very special place for kids. The first American children's book, John Cotton's Spiritual Milk for Boston Babes in Either England, was printed here in 1641. As an early cradle of American literacy, New England had a head start not only in the creation of libraries in general, but in the development of writers who focused on children's literature. From the earliest Puritan primers through Nathaniel Hawthorne and Louisa May Alcott and up to Dr. Seuss, New England has been home and inspiration to scores of the best children's authors in America. Coming up on Storylines New England, we look at New England's rich history of children's literature and the importance of our first books as we revisit a beloved story of life, loyalty, collaboration, and the unique friendship between a cunning spider and a lovable pig on a little farm in Maine. Once again, Kathy Urey.
I would think that there are quite a few books that have New England as a background. Authors who are often writing about colonial times or about the American Revolution. And of course, New England is really the foundation for a lot of children's literature because just by the fact that we started our country on the East Coast and there's such a wealth of literature created in this area. And so it would just be natural that this also would include children's writers who have come up through the ages, from Sarah Josepha Hale writing Mary Had a Little Lamb to Robert McCloskey from Maine.
From the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Storylines New England. I'm Laura Canoy.
And I'm Kevin Gardner. Storylines is a special 13-part radio project of the American Library Association that looks at the literature of our region as a way to better understand who we are as New Englanders and Americans. We've read from the works of Robert Frost, Grace Metalius, and Mark Twain, to name a few, and looked at some of the issues these and other writers have raised, from race relations to the fate of the family farm. Our goal? To gain a better understanding of ourselves as New Englanders, where we've been, where we are, and where we're heading. This week on Storylines, E.B. White's Charlotte's Web and the meaning of literature in children's lives.
Elwin Brooks White did not set out to become a children's writer. He was primarily a journalist, a master of the essay form, whose graceful, wry commentaries for The New Yorker and Harper's Magazine earned him a reputation as one of America's finest prose stylists, long before he published his first book for children. His subject matter was eclectic. He wrote about current affairs, the limits of technology, international politics, and after he moved to Maine in 1939, the joys and ironies of life on a saltwater farm. The story goes that his own children urged him to write something for them, and so in 1945, he produced his first story for kids, Stuart Little. 7 years later, clearly inspired by his rural New England surroundings, he published one of the all-time classics of American children's literature, Charlotte's Web.
Charlotte's Web tells the story of a runty pig named Wilbur, who was rescued by a little girl and then brought to a neighboring farm and raised among a host of animals, from geese to sheep to a rat named Templeton. Wilbur finds true friendship, however, with a big gray spider named Charlotte A. Cavatica, who devises a plan to save Wilbur from the ordinary fate of pigs everywhere.
On foggy mornings, Charlotte's web was truly a thing of beauty. This morning, each thin strand was decorated with dozens of tiny beads of water. The web glistened in the light and made a pattern of loveliness and mystery, like a delicate veil. Even Lurvy, who wasn't particularly interested in beauty, noticed the web when he came with a pig's breakfast. He noted how clearly it showed up, and he noted how big and carefully built it was. And then he took another look, and he saw something that made him set his pail down. There, in the center of the web, neatly woven in block letters, was a message. It said, "Some pig." Lurvy felt weak. He brushed his hand across his eyes and stared harder at Charlotte's web. "I'm seeing things," he whispered. He dropped to his knees and uttered a short prayer. Then, forgetting all about Wilbur's breakfast, he walked back to the house and called Mr. Zuckerman. The two men walked silently down to Wilbur's yard. Lurvy pointed to the spider's web. "Do you see what I see?" he asked. Zuckerman stared at the writing on the web. Then he murmured the words, "Some pig." Then he looked at Lurvy. Then they both began to tremble. Charlotte, sleepy after her night's exertions, smiled as she watched. Wilbur came and stood directly under the web. "Some pig," muttered Lurvy in a low voice. "Some pig," whispered Mr. Zuckerman. They stared and stared for a long time at Wilbur. Then they stared at Charlotte. "You don't suppose that that spider," began Mr. Zuckerman, but he shook his head and didn't finish the sentence. Instead, he walked solemnly back up to the house and spoke to his wife.
In a letter to one of his young readers, E.B. White once said, "In real life, a spider doesn't spin words in her web, but real life is only one kind of life. There is also the life of the imagination. And although my stories are imaginary, I like to think that there is some truth in them, too. Truth about the way people and animals feel and think and act." Charlotte's Web imagines a world of talking pigs and literate spiders, yet it also teaches the realities of life and death, the value of friendship, and the importance of compassion and loyalty.
White stands in a long line of children's writers who've lived in New England, and Charlotte's Web shares its New England roots with Little Women, The Cat in the Hat, Make Way for Ducklings, and even the Hollywood hit Polar Express. Today, our region continues to be a center for children's publishing. New England's tradition of literacy, its varied landscapes and seasons, and its endless accumulation of stories and legends have all contributed enormously to America's childhood reading.
Today on Storylines New England, we're looking at our region as a setting for children's literature and the importance of our first books as we read from the pages of E.B. White's Charlotte's Web. And we want to hear from you, of course, the stories of your first reads and how they influenced you. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. Where do you see New England in children's books? Tell us about the first books that really mattered to you. And how does early reading affect our morals, our values, and our interests? Again, the number, join us, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477.
And joining us now in the studio is Jan Albergine, chair of the English department at Fitchburg State College in Massachusetts, and she's the past president of the Children's Literature Association. Hi, Jan. Welcome to Storylines.
Hi.
And we have also with us Tommy DiPaolo, who lives in New London, New Hampshire. And Tommy, of course, has written or illustrated more than 200 books for children, including 26 Fairmount Avenue, Strega Nona, Meet the Barkers, many others, too numerous to mention. Tommy is also the recipient of both the Caldecott and Newbery Honor Awards for his work. Welcome, Tommy DiPaola.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Tommy, we want to start with you today, and we're going to try and create a little bit of context for ourselves here. Could you define what New England's place in the world of children's literature is, if it has any?
Well, for me, it's where I was born. I was born in Connecticut, and I lived on the West Coast for about 5 years. In 1967 to 71, I was in San Francisco at the right time. But I came back because I missed the seasons. And the minute I got back to New England, I knew that I was going to end up in Upper New England because there's it sounds weird, but there's an isolation that happens in October and doesn't give in until May that really gives my creative juices, soul, and energy, which is, you know, people think that I'm nuts, you know. My parents, my Italian father and my Irish mother, when my father and mother decided to retire, I thought, oh, well, they're going to go to Florida like all the other Italians. No, they moved to Wilmington, Vermont. So I lived in Vermont when I was right out of art school as well. And there's something about, you know, I even though I'm Italian-Irish heritage, I'm not Yankee, which my Southern friends don't understand. They say, yes, you are a Yankee. I say, no, I'm not a Yankee. You don't understand. There's the environment that forces me to work hard and also gives me total joy looking out my window. Just looking out my window. I don't have to go any further than my meadow to be inspired, and it's all New England. We have something very special here that I think everybody, if they knew what it was, they'd be here, and so we don't tell them.
Okay, well, we don't want that. But you're saying that for you, the simple fact of being in New England is essential to your creative process in terms of children's literature.
Absolutely.
Jan Elbergine, in a larger sense, does the production of children's literature have what you might call a New England branch? Is there anything that specifically identifies particular thematic things or concerns of children's literature that you can point to and say, well, that's from New England?
Well, you know, a lot of New England children's writers have characters who end up heading north as the place to find paradise. Yeah. And so I was interested to hear Tommy saying that he knew he would, when he came back to New England, that he was going to go north. And this notion that going north is where you will find, you know, the perfect place, I think has something to do with isolation, with being immersed in the landscape, you know, feeling that those are the places that you can go to be immersed in the landscape, and feeling that those are places that where history is still accessible, both in terms of being able to find the landmarks and being able to find the traditions alive still in some forms.
Jan, I want to talk to you a little bit more about E.B. White in this tradition. How does Charlotte's Web sort of fit into that whole theme that you're talking about?
Well, we could go back a little bit to his first book, Stuart Little,
by the way.
Which starts in New York City, and Stuart heads north following his lady love, a bird named Margalo. And there's a line in there that says, you know, a person could do worse than heading north. And he stops in an idyllic New England village called Ames Corner. And in terms of his own life, he was born outside New York City in New York, worked at the New Yorker, and he and his wife, Catherine White, the redoubtable fiction editor at the New Yorker, bought a saltwater farm in 1933, and they lived there they traveled back and forth for a while, then they lived there for 5 years, came back to New York, and then permanently settled at the farm in, I think, somewhere around 1956.
Mm-hmm. So he sort of personified that.
Yeah, very, you know, very much that.
That vein that you're talking about.
That movement. And, of course, his family had summered in Maine from the time White was a very young child. So he was, you know, familiar with Maine there. And in his teens, early 20s, he worked at a camp in Canada as well.
You know, Tommy, this book is often called a classic children's tale. Almost everyone seems to have read it at some point in their life. I mean, what makes this such a great book?
Well, you know, it's what makes any book a great book. First of all, it's an awfully good story. Awfully good story. And the language is beautiful. I mean, when you read it aloud or listen to it, or read it yourself, but I think the best of children's books especially really make their point when they're read aloud to either oneself, one's family, one's child. That's why story hours are so important in libraries. But it's interesting because I picked up the book again, which I must admit I haven't read it in a long time.
Oh, me too, before I prepared for this show, absolutely.
And I had one question. I couldn't find that it says it takes place in Maine.
No, I don't believe it does.
It doesn't. No. But it does. You know that it takes place in the north.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because you have winter, you have fall, you have muddy spring, and all those things that we have here in New England,
And it's a very short spring
season.
And summer.
Yes, very short.
Yeah, there's a real sense of short amount of time. The other thing
but
you see—
But the characters are— You know, this is what makes it a great book, is that the characters— I remember back in 1967, I was living with one of my twin cousins, you know, for an interim, little interim before I went off to California, and her daughter Leslie was in a Steiner school, and on Sunday night they were serializing Charlotte's Web. Leslie burst into tears. She had heard the story 27 times. Charlotte died again, mommy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh.
You know, that's really powerful, you know? And the story, I was told when I was first getting into books that don't think of stories as children's stories, adult stories. Just think of them as stories.
Mm, good stories.
Good stories. Yeah. And that's what Charlotte's Web is. And E.B. White just like McCloskey, they never veered from, I'm going to write a children's book. I'm going to save my name like somebody else did for my adult book, you know.
Right.
You know, Tommy, I'm glad you mentioned that dark side to Charlotte's Web. And one of the dark facts about it that comes up very early is that Wilbur is going to become a ham for somebody's dinner. That's why they're fattening him up. Let's hear E.B. White himself read that scene from Charlotte's Web where Wilbur learns that he's going to be on the dinner table.
You know why they're fattening you up, don't you? No, said Wilbur. Well, I don't like to spread bad news, said the sheep. But they're fattening you up because they're going to kill you. That's why. They're going to what? Screamed Wilbur. Fern grew rigid on her stool. Kill you. Turn you into smoked bacon and ham, continued the old sheep. Almost all young pigs get murdered by the farmer as soon as the real cold weather sets in. There's a regular conspiracy around here to kill you at Christmas time. Everybody is in the plot. Lurvy, Zuckerman, even John Arable. Mr. Arable? Sobbed Wilbur. Fern's father? Certainly. When a pig is to be butchered, everybody helps. I'm an old sheep, and I see the same thing, same old business year after year. Arable arrives with his 22, shoots the... Wilbur burst into tears. I don't want to die, he moaned. I want to stay alive right here in my comfortable manure pile with all my friends. I want to breathe the beautiful air and lie in the beautiful sun. You're certainly making a beautiful noise, snapped the old sheep. I don't want to die, screamed Wilbur, throwing himself to the ground. You shall not die, said Charlotte briskly. What? Really? Cried Wilbur. Who's going to save me? I am, said Charlotte. How? Asked Wilbur. That remains to be seen. But I am going to save you, and I want you to quiet down immediately. You're carrying on in a childish way. Stop your crying. I can't stand hysterics.
And you're listening to Storylines New England. I'm Kevin Gardner along with Laura Kanoy. And today we are talking about E.B. White's Charlotte's Web, which we just heard a bit of read by the author himself, and New England's children's literature, along with Jan Albergine, chair of the English department at Fitchburg State College in Massachusetts, and Tommy DiPaolo, very well known author and illustrator of more than 200 books for young people. Jan Albergine, I want to ask you a question about how White handles some of the darker themes in Charlotte's Web, because the impending death of Wilbur, he's threatened with death twice in this book, is not the only bit of darkness we have here. For instance, the title character of the book dies in a very lonely death, and not at the end of the book, but somewhat before its end. And as well, the main helping character in the book, Templeton the Rat, is actually a rather vicious and self-centered piece of vermin, personally.
Really, how do you really feel, Kevin?
Isn't a very attractive character at all, and yet is essential to the movement of the book. What does White do that's so skillful in managing to explore these dark themes without making the whole book kind of depressing?
Okay. I think the reason I pause there is because I can see why you're saying there are dark themes. However, I've never seen it as dark, say, in the way I would see some of the themes in another New England writer, Robert Cormier. And I think that what keeps it from being, from seeming dark, both to me and to child readers, is the fact that when, White expressed it this way, when someone asked him what he was trying to say in his books, he said, all I'm ever trying to say is that I love life. And, of course, that's a kind of thing that could put a damper on critical discussion, but life covers a whole lot of territory, so there is a lot for us to talk about. And he's placing death within the whole cycle of what life is. And he doesn't leave us without ways in which to remember Charlotte. And he also leaves behind people, you know, her daughters, who remember her. And I also think that the humor of the book, which operates on two levels, on one level for children and on a constant level, I think, for adults, because, you know, that line about there's a regular conspiracy to kill you around Christmas time, here around Christmas time. Well, White himself felt that there was a regular conspiracy to kill him around Christmas time, because they would be inundated with, you know, all these children's books that they were supposed – that his wife was reviewing. And there were so many requests for, you know, for things to do and presents to buy. And he was very conscientious, and he would get very, you know, fussed about all that. And so, you know, some of that is, you know, is, you know, very tongue-in-cheek, I think, for White himself. Mm-hmm. One of my friends once told me that when her son was seven and they were having – bacon for breakfast in their Vermont home, he raised a piece of bacon to his mouth and he started nibbling it, and he said, "Wilbur, Wilbur, Wilbur, you're so delicious."
Oh no. You know, I was wondering about that, if this book inspired children to, if not become vegetarians, at least to avoid bacon and ham.
Well, I thought this is a typical little boy response, whereas White, when he was doing the recording of Charlotte's Web, broke down when he got to the part where Charlotte died. And he said he was embarrassed, but that every time he read it, you know, he himself cried.
Oh, that happens to me, too. Yeah. So that happens to me, too. I can't read it to this day without misting over when I come to that section. Tommy, Jan said something fascinating about the effect that White's handling of the darker nature of Charlotte's Web had on later writers like Robert Cormier. Do you agree with that? Do you think that White's handling of this material had some effect on children's authors who came after him?
I suppose yes and no. I think with good authors, the effect on good authors is the effect of their own lives. You know, sometimes if someone breaks a mold that's been in place, like, for instance, Sendax, Where the Wild Things Are. The only thing is, I point out to people, Max is not the first naughty little boy. you know, in children's literature.
Right.
He was the naughty little boy that came up in the 50s because everyone had forgotten about Peter Rabbit. He's naughty.
And Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, who didn't you want to be Huck Finn, you know? Right. I wanted to be Huck Finn.
Sure.
I didn't want to be Tom. He got stuck there, you know? But Peter Rabbit, I have a very personal thing about Peter Rabbit because I didn't get to play Peter. There's a new book coming out in the spring, Laurel. But I thought that Peter Rabbit was a naughty little boy.
Yeah.
But now that gave me the permission to write about my own naughtiness, my own darkness. I mean, I don't think that E.B. White, you know, everyone said, oh, I can write. I think Robert Cormier, I knew him. I was fortunate enough to know him. He wrote about things that he saw in those mill towns that he grew up in. E.B. White, I think it's fascinating. Anyone that has a farm, you know, Fern gets to be pretty wishy-washy, doesn't she?
Yes, I mean, and then he sort of abandons her and pushes her aside.
And, you know, because it's the animals. It's the sheep. It's the goose. It's the rat,
right.
You know, that are the important. But see, now this is also gives us writers for children, quote, a permission. He's just one of many people who have given us permission to speak our voices through animals. Through anthropomorphizing animals in a way, although they don't wear clothes, which is great.
Yeah.
Although I did think Peter Rabbit's little blue jacket. Is pretty
It's very fetching.
It was a more
and
decorous
he loses
era.
It. Yeah, he leaves.
And
yeah,
his
he
little
loses
shoes.
It. Yeah, he loses all that stuff. He loses.
It is interesting how you know animals so often in children's literature are the lead characters.
That's a New England thing, too. Because,
is it?
Well, I think so, because I think animals, especially when you get out of the cities, you know, the New England, people forget New England is not just New Hampshire, Vermont, Maine. It's also Bridgeport, Connecticut, Lowell, Massachusetts.
Cities with real
right,
city
exactly,
problems.
Providence, Rhode Island in the early days. It's really, it's sort of that dichotomy, you know. You have the mill towns, then you have the rural stuff. And if you experience the rural stuff, you don't have electricity. They're doing this wonderful program on Vermont Public Television about Vermont in the early days, you know, how the town had electric lights. They didn't have electric lights on the farm. But on the farm, the animals are part of your existence. You know, I have a meadow that has at least 25 woodchucks in it. I don't like them, but they're there.
Oh, and they're cute, Tommy.
Oh, yeah, right.
they are.
Laura, I'm going to write a woodchuck story, the dark side of the woodchucks.
Yeah, and White made a clear distinction between mice and rats.
He thought mice were fine,
but he didn't think rats were fine.
And we all know he's right.
Yeah, he went out and shot the rats. You know, he wasn't fond of them at all.
And he had a farm himself.
Yes.
Saltwater farm.
Yes.
Which has its own difficulties, which we won't go into right now because we're heading into a break. But yeah, he was immersed in this.
Yes.
He knew what he was talking about. All right. Coming up after a short break, we'll talk more about children's literature in New England through the pages of E.B. White's Charlotte's Web. But we're also going to get into some other famous authors and illustrators from our region. And we'll take your calls at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477.
For more information on Storylines New England or the books that we're reading, visit our website, storyline.ala.org, or check out your local public library. The libraries have copies of the books, program schedules, and our discussion guides. I'm Kevin Gardner.
And I'm Laura Kanoy. You're listening to Storylines New England.
Storylines New England is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
From the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Storylines New England. I'm Kevin Gardner.
And I'm Laura Kanoy. Each week on Storylines, we look at a particular New England author's work as a way to try and better understand ourselves as New Englanders, where we've been, where we are, and where we're heading. Today, we're reading from E.B. White's Charlotte's Web and looking at the impact our first books have on our lives, from our values to our interests to how we see the world. E.B. White was born in New York, but lived much of his life in an old farmhouse in the coastal Maine town of North Brooklyn. There, White found inspiration for his classic book, Charlotte's Web, the story of a pig named Wilbur, and his friendship with a talented spider called Charlotte.
A crisis arises when Wilbur learns he's being raised for slaughter in the fall, but Charlotte devises a way to save her friend by spelling words of praise for him into her web. Her first effort, Some Pig, certainly has the desired effect for a while, but soon the helpful spider realizes she needs to come up with something new. So she gathers all the animals of the farm, and they meet to decide what the new word praising Wilbur's unique quality should be. Here's E.B. White himself reading that passage from Charlotte's Web.
Now I called this meeting in order to get suggestions. I need new ideas for the web. People are already getting sick of reading the words, some pig. If anybody can think of another message or remark, I'll be glad to weave it into the web. Any suggestions? How about Pig Supreme? Asked one of the lambs. No good, said Charlotte. It sounds like a rich dessert. How about Terrific, Terrific, Terrific? Asked the goose. Cut that down to one terrific, and it will do very nicely, said Charlotte. I think terrific might impress Zuckerman. But Charlotte, said Wilbur, I'm not terrific. That doesn't make a particle of difference, replied Charlotte. Not a particle. People believe almost anything they see in print. Does anybody here know how to spell terrific? I think, said the gander, it's TEERRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRR been discussed. I would have to have St. Vitus's dance to weave a word like that into my web. Sorry, 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 said the gander. Then the oldest sheep spoke up. I agree that there should be something new written in the web if Wilbur's life is to be saved. And if Charlotte needs help in finding words, I think she can get it from our friend Templeton. The rat visits the dump regularly and has access to old magazines. He can tear out bits of advertisements and bring them up here to the barn cellar so that Charlotte can have something to copy. Good idea, said Charlotte. But I'm not sure Templeton will be willing to help. You know how he is, always looking out for himself, never thinking of the other fellow. I bet I can get him to help, said the old sheep. I'll appeal to his baser instincts, of which he has plenty. Here he comes now. Everybody keep quiet while I put the matter up to him.
So much of E.B. White's book is influenced by his residence in New England. The changing seasons, Yankee farm life, even its gathering of animals seems to resemble an old-fashioned town meeting. And many other children's authors, from Louisa May Alcott and Robert McCloskey to the poet Donald Hall, have found literary inspiration among the hills and woods and shorelines of our region.
Today on Storylines New England, we're talking about how New England has been represented in children's literature and the role that those first books play in our upbringing as we return to the pages of E.B. White's Charlotte's Web. And we're taking your calls at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. How did your first books influence you? Your values, your interests, and what is it about our region that has made it such a successful incubator of children's literature? Again, our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477.
Our guests for the hour are Tommy DiPaola, award-winning author and illustrator of more than 200 books for young people. Tommy's based in New London, New Hampshire. We're also joined by Jan Albergine, chair of the English department at Fitchburg State College in Massachusetts and past president of the Children's Literature Association. And Tommy and Jan, let's go right to those phones and go to Hopkinton, New Hampshire first. Joanne is up. Hi, Joanne. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. What a wonderful subject for a program. I'm enjoying this so much, especially as an early childhood teacher and an elementary school teacher. I think my love of books as a child probably fueled that career to some extent. But what I wanted to mention was the early copy that I used to have of E.B. White's Charlotte's Web was illustrated by a wonderful illustrator who just touched me as a child by the name of Garth Williams.
Oh, yes.
And I don't know if Garth was a New Englander, but he just he brought that book as well as others to life for me. And in addition to Garth Williams, one of my other favorite children's illustrators and authors was a woman that I think Kevin probably knew because she grew up quite near to Hopkinton and her children went to Hopkinton schools, and that was Tasha Tudor.
You know, Joanne, Tasha Tudor used to come and visit us when I was in the Hopkinton schools, and she really got our attention one day when she came in and read a little bit of the book she was illustrating at the time, which was that classic version of The Secret Garden.
Yes.
And she told a class full of fourth grade students that she wanted us all to go looking for dead animals along the side of the road that had been hit by cars, and if we found any, to bring them to her house where she could use them for life studies.
Well, well, she was a woman who could bring the past to life
mm-hmm.
for children. And it was the way she lived, very much as if she was still in the 1800s and early 1900s.
Oh, yes. She came in old-fashioned clothes.
Yes, and her wonderful dollhouse
mm-hmm.
that was
mm-hmm.
the size that filled a full room.
Now, Joanne, was she – I know her author, her work as an illustrator. Was she an author also, Tasha
Tudor? She was an author as well.
Yeah.
Many of her books – and Kevin talks about the animals that she encouraged the kids to bring to her.
Mm-hmm.
Many of her books were written about family pets.
You know, Joanne, I'm glad that she mentioned Tasha Tudor. Excuse me for interrupting you, Joanne, for a second. It raises a question in my mind for you, Jan, and that is, who else in your own life has been influential? You know, Joanne's mentioning Tasha Tudor, someone that many people here in New England have heard of, but people outside New England may not have heard of. What other New England authors were influential in your life?
Well, Louisa May Alcott was very influential. Like
sure.
Most women of my generation, I read Little Women over and over. Now, Alcott enjoyed a revival when the 1994 film version came out. But young girls don't read Little Women today in the way that women of my generation
mm-hmm.
did. And I think that's because the girls were not particularly satisfied with just the notion of being a housewife. They wanted to carve out roles for themselves in the world. And the book was a book that I would read yearly, and I would go and sit in the apple tree in our backyard in Chelmsford, Massachusetts, not that far from Concord, and reread Little Women wearing the army helmet that belonged to my toy army helmet that belonged to my brother because the little green apples would fall and hit me on the head.
And, you could have found another spot, Jan.
Well, but I liked being in the tree because Joe got up in the tree and she
right.
read in trees.
That's right.
Yeah.
So
that's
I was going to do the same thing. So I grew up to be somebody who wrote about Alcott in my dissertation and then in a book.
Right.
And I remember coming back from studying manuscripts at the Houghton Library and my knees really hurt because I had been sitting there not moving, poring over these manuscripts. And I mentioned it to the man who was eventually to become my husband. And David said, Jan, it's not necessary to kneel in front of the manuscripts.
In a worshipful pose.
But, you know.
That's a great story.
But it was perfect because really that's how I felt.
Yeah. How about you, Tommy?
Well, you know, the very first book that had an impact on me was a book called Hitty, Her First 100 Years by Rachel Field. And with beautiful black and white illustrations by Dorothy Luthrop. And they were both Hitty starts in the window of a Boston antique shop.
It's New York.
Is it New York?
Yeah.
Well, these years I've been misled. I obviously thought it was
yeah.
Boston.
It was New York.
It's okay. I thought
but,
Charlotte's Web took place in the Midwest.
So there you go.
Yeah.
But Hitty herself, mm-hmm. the doll, was carved from a piece of mountain ash from Maine. And I have a mountain ash tree in my yard as a tribute to Hitty, her, you know,
oh.
the doll.
Oh, sweet.
Because this was an incredible book. But Louisa May Alcott's Little Women, the character of Jo had a great deal of influence on me because there is that wonderful passage where Jo sells her first story and she suddenly realizes, I can get out of this way of living. I can make my own living and be master of my own fate. And it's a wonderful, wonderful moment. Robert McCloskey growing up. Homer Price was published when I was in, like, sixth grade.
Yes.
And we finally got a donut machine like that in Kresge's in downtown Meriden. And, you know, boy, oh, boy, did we all want to go get donuts to find the diamond bracelet.
You know, Tommy, I'm so glad you mentioned Robert McCloskey because he is one of my favorite children's authors, wonderful. Besides you, of course.
Oh, that's all right.
Nope. And you're my favorite still living author.
Okay, thank you. I'll buy that.
But I love Robert McCloskey. Yeah. And one reason why I love him is he does what you and Jan talked about at the beginning of this program, and that is present the New England landscape as just this perfect, idyllic, you know, fabulous place for children. We have a reading from Robert McCloskey's One Morning in Maine, where he uses the stunning backdrop of rural coastal Maine to paint an idyllic picture of New England. Here's a scene where the main character in the book, Sal, finds out she has a loose tooth, and our reading is read by Anna Van Sice.
After breakfast, when Sal went out to help her father, she saw a fish hawk flying overhead, carrying a fish. I have a loose tooth, Sal called up to the fish hawk. The fish hawk flew straight to her nest on top of a tree without answering. She was too busy feeding breakfast to her baby fish hawk. Sal wondered for a moment if the baby fish hawk had any teeth to chew his breakfast. Then she started on down toward the beach where her father was digging clams. When she came near to the water, she saw a loon. I have a loose tooth, Sal called to the loon, and today I have started to be a big girl. The loon didn't say anything but kept swimming in circles. Then he ducked his beak in the water and snapped out a herring. Then he swallowed it whole without a single chew. Perhaps loons don't have teeth, thought Sal. And she was just turning to go on her way when a seal poked his head up out of the water. I have a loose tooth, Sal said to the seal, and the seal, being just as curious as most seals, swam nearer to have a good look. See, said Sal, and she walked closer right down onto the slippery seaweeds at the water's edge. The seal swam nearer, and Sal was stooping nearer when, whoops, she slipped on the seaweed and fell, ka-sploosh. The seal disappeared beneath the water, and the loon laughed. La-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo. Sal wasn't hurt a bit, so she laughed too, and then she got up carefully and started down the shore to help her father dig clams.
And you're listening to Storylines New England. I'm Kevin Gardner along with Laura Kanoy. And today on Storylines, of course, we are talking about E.B. White's Charlotte's Web and New England children's literature. And we're looking at our region's role in American writing for kids and the influence that books have on us as children. And we want you to join us with your calls, too, at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. And now joining us from his home in Warner, New Hampshire, is David Elliott, playwright and children's author and director of the Department of English Language and American Culture at Colby Sawyer College. He's also a writing teacher at Boston's Lesley University. David's own books include the wonderfully titled The Transmogrification of Roscoe Wizzle and Hazel Nutt, Mad Scientist, among others. And David Elliott, welcome to Storylines.
Thanks very much. Hi, everybody.
David, we've been talking a little bit about the presence of the New England landscape in children's literature, and I know that you've been living in Warner, which is a small town in central New Hampshire, for some time now. Can you give us some sense of how living in this landscape has affected you as a writer?
Well, you know, I was thinking of the opening of the show when you were talking about E.B. White responding to one of his younger readers.
Mm-hmm.
And in that letter, he talked about the life of the imagination, and at the same time, he said... you know, but I also, my books are real. And I think in some ways, for me at least, the landscape, the New England landscape, really symbolizes, it's kind of a coming together of both those ideas. There's something about the life here that pleases the imagination, I think. And at the same time, nothing could be more real than trying to get up your driveway on a winter's day or in mud season or the granite that we have, at least in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
And just as an example of that, just of the way these things come together sometimes. A couple of years ago, I was out walking basically in my yard in here in Warner. And it was very early in the morning. I had a new puppy. I was out walking the puppy, and I had my coffee. And I looked up, and about 50, it was one of those foggy New England mornings. And I looked up, and through the fog, about 50 feet in front of me, there was a moose. And I think that cannot happen anyplace else in the world, I think. And when I got back in the house, you know, it's almost as if it didn't happen. It was kind of a coming together of what's real and what's imagined.
So it immediately becomes something in your imagination.
It does. It is now there forever. And not just the image of that, but the feeling of it, that moment of surprise when out of nowhere, mm-hmm. you're kind of in another world.
Now, David, we have an awful lot of people who want to talk to us on the telephone, but just quickly, would you tell us, if you can reach back that far in your ancient memory?
It is very far.
I know. Tell us what books, when you were very young, really struck you, books you've never really been able to leave behind.
Well, you know, I grew up in a small town in Ohio, and I was kind of from a poor family, but my mother managed to scrape together enough to allow me to join the Weekly Reader Children's Book Club, and I so much remember getting every couple of months, I guess, some of the books through this book club. And one of those books was called No Children, No Pets, and another was called Island Boy, and I think that was by someone named R.R. Harry. And what I loved about Island Boy was in the back there was a glossary of all these Hawaiian words with their short syllables and all those L's and K's, which could not have been farther from Ohio, which I think is one reason I loved it. Mm-hmm. But I think the first book that really spoke to me was Kidnapped by Robert Louis Stevenson. You know, I think partly because, frankly, you know, the main character's name, my name is David, and the main character's name in Kidnapped is Davy Balfour. And it was just at a time in my life, in my younger life, when I was feeling endangered, and he was very much endangered. And but he made it. And in my own way, I did too. And I think in some ways, I can look at Davy Balfour and say, thank you for showing me that it's possible.
Well, David, thank you very much for joining us. We sure appreciate it.
Thanks,
David.
You're
quite welcome, Lauren. Happy holidays, everybody.
You too.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. 1-800-892-6477. That was David Elliott, a playwright and children's author based here in New Hampshire. 1-800-892-6477 is the number here on Storylines New England. I'm Laura Canoy along with Kevin Gardner. Our guests for the hour, Jen Albergine, chair of the English department at Fitchburg State College, past president of the Children's Literature Association, and Tommy DiPaola, award-winning author and illustrator of more than 200 books for young people. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Let's go to Wilmot, New Hampshire next, and Mary Jane's on the air. Hi, Mary Jane, go ahead.
Hello, Laura. I wanted to say I grew up listening to stories read, but I was not a reader. My dad used to read the Thornton Burgess animal stories and recite James Whitcomb Riley and Robert Frost, but I feel blessed to live in this area because of Tommy DiPaolo and Mary Lynn Ray and Donald Hall, and they've enriched my life as well as the students that I teach and my own family, and I just wanted to give them a big hug on the air.
All right, Mary Jane, thanks for calling.
Accept it.
Hi, Tommy.
Let's go to, thanks, Mary Jane, for calling. We'll go to Waterbury Center, Vermont next and talk to Maggie. She's up from there. Hi, Maggie, go ahead. You're on Storylines New England.
Hi. I'm calling for a rather personal reason. Tommy DiPaolo is actually a distant cousin of mine. My great-grandmother was his great-aunt, I believe. And he wrote about my great-grandmother in one of his books. And she raised my mother. My mother and my dad have all these amazing stories about her. And she loved the word grand, and she would start to sweep in the house and sweep down the whole sidewalk into the street. And it's been one of my greatest pleasures to go to my niece's school and be able to read one of Tommy's books and have a picture of my great-grandmother there and be able to explain to all the students in the class, this is my niece's great-great-grandmother. And it was just such, and I've never, he knows my mother and my aunt, Ellen and Peggy, but I've always wanted the opportunity to be, Tommy, you rock.
And my family is
so blessed to have any connection. And you've definitely enriched.
Oh, thank you.
Like, I feel enriched just having a connection at all, so I really appreciate
that.
Well,
thanks.
And also, E.B. White, I wasn't a reader as a child, and my mother, being a teacher, was quite frustrated with that. And then finally I got an E.B. White book, and which was Trump or the Swan, and I devoured them all. Like anything he wrote, I wanted to read. It definitely started my appetite for reading.
Now, what was it about him, Maggie, versus anybody else?
Actually, it's funny because you just mentioned my mother. One of the first books, she's like, Maggie, you're going to love this, was Little Women, and I didn't like it at all. And I don't know. It just that actually kind of turned me off. And then I don't know what it was. I loved the care. I guess because I grew up in a very rural place with a lot of animals around as well. And I guess I related to animals much more than I did to maybe the women in Little Women. So about the trumpet and about the swan and about like the animals in Charlotte's Web, I felt much more comfortable reading about animals.
Well, I think this gets back to what both of you said earlier, that children relate to animals, and it's a theme that you see in children's books again and again. And here we've got a caller, Maggie, who's saying just that.
We better take another call, Laura. This is Dawn now from Freedom, New Hampshire. Hi, Dawn. Go ahead. Hi there, Dawn. Are you there?
Yes, I am. I wanted to also talk about the first time I read Charlotte's Web. I read it as a third grader. My mother gave it to me, forced me to read it because I didn't think I could read chapter books yet.
You read it all by yourself?
Oh, all by myself.
Good job.
And I could read chapter books, I guess. And I remember lying on my bed, finishing the book, and then walking into the kitchen. My mom, my aunt, my father were there, crying my eyes out.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, why did you make me read this book?
Oh,
dies.
Oh, Dawn, what a story.
I know. It was so sad.
Now, Dawn, the end of the book is not actually sad, but you must be talking about how it carried through, how Charlotte's death just colors everything that happens after it. Is that fair to say?
I think so. The friendship just developed so beautifully. The end of the book, her babies are born, but I mm-hmm. just cared about Charlotte.
Right. It didn't matter to
you. He didn't develop the babies' personalities as much. I think it was also the first time I really thought about that animals may have their own thoughts,
right.
That animals have families and friends. I remember after that thinking, I don't want my dog to watch me get in the bathtub because he might tell me what I look like.
Dawn, that's fantastic. And it's such a wonderful example of how you cannot predict what children are going to take from a book that they read. And Tommy, as you write books, you must be mindful of the fact that children go into a book and they don't necessarily look at what it is you think you're putting in there for them to take out, do they?
I don't think about that, to be perfectly honest. When I'm working on my book, I don't think about anything else but my telling the story that I've chosen to tell,
mm-hmm.
and to tell it hopefully in such a way that it will engage, you know, people, children and grown-ups, to want to read it.
Mm-hmm.
And, I haven't really written my big New England book yet, but who knows? It might be coming. I'm writing about my childhood, which I'm having a great time doing chapter books. But, you know, with me, the because I'm an illustrator as well, just living in New London in my wonderful house affects every single line I put on the page, whether it's about Italy or New England or what Mexico. It does really affect. But I don't consciously do that. And I don't think E.B. White consciously did it either.
It's hard to think that he did.
Yeah, yeah. It really is. Because I don't think – then it becomes, okay, I'm going to teach you a lesson.
Right, right. Jan Elbergine, do you think it's fair to say that that's a feature of the best children's writing from New England or anywhere, that it doesn't consciously try to engage children in any particular place but just honestly tells its own story, as Tommy was just describing?
Yes, and I think that Tommy said he didn't think that White was trying to, you know, push any particular lesson. And I absolutely agree with that. White, like Tommy, though, was very meticulous and very careful about language. And he cared very much about what the illustrations look like. And so I think that desire to make the book be the absolute best that it could be. And, you know, one of the best definitions I've heard for a children's book is that is the form that the story takes, you know, and that's mm-hmm. that's the way you tell it. And so you don't write down, You know, you write you write to your fullest, and you're engaging both the child in yourself and the adult. So it's I think that it can be much richer even than texts that are for an adult audience.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, let me follow up on that point because it's a great one. A good children's book doesn't hit you over the head with the moral or the lesson, but it does impart something.
It affects you one way or
another. At least you hope. Yeah. Tommy, I'm going to ask you to read from someone else's work, from Dr. Seuss's work, the classic children's story, How the Grinch Stole Christmas, appropriate for this time of year, where Dr. Seuss is clearly trying to pass on a message to children, but he does it in such a clever way. At this point, the Grinch has taken all the Christmas stuff from the Whos and is ready to dump it and enjoy the sound of sobbing Whos.
And this is the first hearing Tommy DiPaolo read Seuss. "That's a noise," grinned the Grinch, "that I simply must hear." So he paused, and the Grinch put his hand to his ear. And he did hear a sound rising over the snow. It started in low, then it started to grow. But the sound wasn't sad. Why, the sound sounded merry. It couldn't be so, but it was merry, very. He stared at Whoville. The Grinch popped his eyes. Then he shook. What he saw was a shocking surprise. Every Who down in Whoville, the tall and the small, was singing, without any presents at all. He hadn't stopped Christmas from coming. It came. Somehow or other, it came just the same. And the Grinch with his Grinch feet, ice cold in the snow, stood puzzling and puzzling. How could it be so? It came without ribbons. It came without tags. It came without packages, boxes, or bags. And he puzzled 3 hours till his puzzler was sore. Then the Grinch thought of something he hadn't before. Maybe Christmas, he thought, doesn't come from a store. Maybe Christmas, perhaps, means a little bit more.
Oh, and Tommy, we're going to end it at that. And thank you so much for reading that. And thank you so much for coming in. We really appreciate
it.
And Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, Happy Holidays, and all that.
Thank you. Same to you and all your listeners.
Tommy DiPaolo, award-winning author and illustrator of more than 200 books for young people. Jen Albergine, so good to have you, too.
Thank you.
Jen Albergine, chair of the English department at Fitchburg State College and past president of the Children's Literature Association.
For more information about Storylines New England or the books in our series, go to our website at storylines.ala.org.
Storylines New England is produced by Keith Shields. The engineer is Andrew Walsh. Anna Van Sice performed our reading of One Morning in Maine. Library discussion guides were written by Bill Ott. Georgia Lomax coordinates the participating libraries.
And the executive producer of the Storylines America series is Paul Zalis. Storylines New England comes to you from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio in Concord, New Hampshire. I'm Kevin Gardner.
And I'm Laura Kanoy. Join us next week for Storylines New England.
Hang up hoo-boo-hoo, bricks.
Then run out and get some more.
Hang them kookas on the ceiling, pile pampoonas on the floor. Trim every blessed needle on the blessed Christmas tree.
Storylines New England is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Trim up your uncle and your aunt with yards of hoo-fun.
Next time on Storylines New England, our historic relationship with the sea and John Casey's novel Spartina, a classic tale of a man, his boat, and a storm.
Set on Rhode Island's south coast, Spartina tells the story of one man's struggle to succeed in New England's troubled fishing industry.
Sailors, Ships, and the Sea on the next Storylines New England.